Critical Readings, a podcast of literary discussion and analysis, starring Sean Philip Cooper and Drew Keane. Hello and welcome to Critical Readings, episode 163 for the 20th of February, 2023. I'm Dr. Sean Cooper, and with me today I have Dr. Drew Keane.
Salutations.
Good afternoon, Drew. Well, today we're going to look at perhaps one of the most famous female poets of the 20th century, although she was born in the 19th century, and that is Edna St. Vincent Millay. And Edna St. Vincent Millay bucked the trend of the 20th century, which was to write poetry of an increasingly formless nature, or a rejection of forms, or that subverted forms or deconstructed forms, however you want to put it. And instead, she specialized in formal poetry, and particularly in the sonnet, of which she wrote many, some collected numerically, like what we're going to read today, some of them published individually, some of them published alongside other less formal poetry in collections. Her output was prodigious, and I think it would be fair to say sometimes of variable quality. But quite a bit of her poetry has come down to us and is celebrated justly because it shows a really exquisite mastery of form. And also, she anticipates in many ways some of the sort of activist or confessional poetry that would become really popular in the mid-20th century, for example, the work of Sylvia Plath, right? So we'll see today an example of that in what is probably her most celebrated, although I'm not a Millay scholar, and that would be her I Being Born a Woman and Distressed. And I think the title there is probably sufficient to indicate the kind of poetry that we're talking about when we talk about confessional or activist poetry, right? But a little bit about her before we get started. As I mentioned, she was born in the 19th century. She was born in 1892. In fact, she was born in February on the 22nd, which is coming up this week, right? So if she was born in 1892, that would make her 131 this year. Have I got that right? I think. I'm not a math major either. Her 131st birthday is coming up this week. And she wrote dramatic works, not just poems, right? She wrote Aria da Capo, The Lamp and the Bell. She wrote the libretto for an opera, The King's Henchman. And she has several collections, A Few Figs from Thistle, Second April, Ballad of the Harp Weaver, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1923. She has a lot in common with Robert Frost, both born in the 19th century, but are known to us primarily as poets of the early 20th century, what we might call fin de siècle poets, right? Turn of the century, end of the century poets. And she was a sort of feminist icon. She had very progressive political stances, took a very liberal view, especially considering the time, of homosexuality, believed in the description of female expression and experience and empowerment. And her biographer, Nancy Milford, said that she became the herald of the new woman. Right? So sort of progressive, feminist, liberal, so on and so forth, independent. Her mother raised her largely on her own, having divorced her father and become a nurse in order to support herself and her three daughters. They were very poor, but her mother promoted reading and so on and so forth. And she was constantly encouraged to learn and excel. Millay, when younger, wanted to be a concert pianist, not actually a poet. But over time, she realized that her talents and skills lay elsewhere. Her hands were very small, made it difficult. Her teacher said, "You're probably not going to be a concert pianist. You need bigger hands." So she focused on writing, and her poems first appeared from 1906 to 1910 in the children's magazine, which was very widely read at the time, St. Nicholas. One of her prize poems was reprinted in the 1907 issue of Current Opinion. By 1912, she was writing that she was well acquainted with William Shakespeare, John Milton, William Wordsworth, Tennyson, Dickens, Walter Scott, George Eliot, and Henrik Ibsen, a great Norwegian playwright. And she also mentioned some 50 other authors as well. So there's something to be said for reading well. It will do the job of teaching you poetry and poetic forms if you read a great deal of poetry. You kind of absorb them.
In that similar vein, we discussed this briefly before we started recording. I think that in many ways she resists Harold Bloom's account of how poetry develops, or literature in general develops over time, where each generation is a reaction to the preceding generation in a kind of Freudian, you know, Oedipus killing his father type cycle.
Yes.
Whereas in her case, you can see the imbibing of the tradition and then the production of something that is both new and also clearly coming out of a living tradition in the way that Eliot talks about in Tradition and the Individual Talent.
Indeed. And I think you see that in some of her longer works, particularly her Renaissance, about which I should mention, she submitted it to a poetry contest sponsored by the Lyric Year, which is an annual anthology. The editor, Ferdinand Earle, liked the poem so well, he wrote to her, expressing confidence it would be awarded first prize. "You're certain to win," he basically told her. But the other judges disagreed, and it won no prize at all. That must have been extremely disappointing to her. However, it received great praise when the Lyric Year appeared in November of 1912, and a school director who heard Millay recite her poetry, Carolyn B. Dow, and play her own compositions for piano, determined that she should go to college. Mrs. Dow promised to contribute to her expenses, so Millay applied for scholarships to Vassar, took courses at Barnard, and she received the education that developed her into a cultured and learned poet at Vassar. Moving to New York in the fall of 17, where she refused a job, a comfortable job no less, secretary to a very wealthy woman, and there Kennerly published her first book, Renaissance and Other Poems. She even acted in a play in that December. She was a part in Floyd Dell, the socialist, a very famous socialist Floyd Dell. The Angel Intrudes, which is being presented in Greenwich Village. She fell in love with him. They had a sort of affair that continued for a year and a bit. And then he was charged with obstructing the war effort, being a socialist, of course, right? It's great war is on. She had several affairs with different men and women, and her relationship with him disintegrated. But she never became a communist. She was sympathetic to socialism, right? And she was a very sort of bohemian, nonconformist. She met all sorts of different people, carried on poetic liaisons, love liaisons, musical liaisons throughout the 19-teens and into the 1920s. By her later years, she was a little more famous than she had been in those early years. She had become something of the doyenne of feminist literature, feminist poetry. This is why I think it's so important to understand her as integral to the development of Sylvia Plath, right? I think there's quite a lot that we can get out of Edna St. Vincent Millay that we see going in that direction.
And also, most notably, I'd say Elizabeth Bishop. I'd say she's probably one of the biggest influences on Bishop.
Huge, right? In fact, there's you could probably read their poetry side by side and find it difficult to separate it at times. In any case, during the Second World War, Millay had originally started out as a pacifist and then switched after the bombing of Pearl Harbor to becoming a sort of propagandist for the United States, right? Writing recruitment slogans and poetry, although she remained critical of capitalism and was still sympathetic to socialism.
And after she got out of this propagandistic writing phase, she ended up admitting how terrible most of that poetry was. She said, "To acres and acres of bad poetry."
After the Second World War, her health and reputation and her work all declined. She had developed a morphine addiction following an accident. She sought treatment for it and did manage to get rehabilitated. But her longtime partner died of lung cancer in 1949, and she was alone for the rest of her life. Her final collection of poems was published posthumously, a collection called Mine the Harvest. And the title sonnet, Mine the Harvest, recalls her career. She died at her home on the 19th of October, 1950. She was 58 years old. She had fallen down the stairs and broke her neck. And she was found about 8 hours later. She had suffered a heart attack at the top of the stairs, it sounds, and then fell down the stairs. And she is buried alongside her husband at Steepletop, Austerlitz in New York. And the grave is this massive block of stone with the plaques on it at Steepletop. And you can go there and see it. When she died, the New York Times described her as the idol of the younger generation during the glorious early days of Greenwich Village. One of the greatest American poets of her time, Thomas Hardy said America had two great attractions, the skyscraper and the poet of Edna St. Vincent Millay. Richard Wilbur said that Millay wrote some of the best sonnets of the century.
I'd agree.
There you go. So we're going to look at her now and look at some of her poetry. We do not have time, unfortunately, to read Renaissance, which other than I Being Born a Woman in Distress is probably her most famous poem. It's less anthologized because it's much longer.
As an aside, I wonder to what extent the trend of anthologizing poetry for the purposes of making it easily digestible to students has forced us into liking short poems over long poems.
I agree entirely. And I see this, this is something I've wondered, and it comes up on Twitter all the time. People saying, do you know of any venues for publication for longer poetry? And I say, no, I don't. I wish I did. But it seems like the only way to get longer poetry published is you have to write a whole bunch of short poetry, get it published a bunch of places, and then put together your own collection and include the longer poetry in it. And
Hidden amongst all the short pieces.
Yeah, exactly, right? And it seems to me such a terrible way of doing things, because one of the benefits of writing short poetry and having it published is then you get input on it, right? Editors, if in case you're wondering, listeners, you don't write the poem and then just send it off. You know, you work on it yourself, and then you send it off, and then the editor says, well, what about X, Y, and Z? And they suggest a bunch of changes. And some people get really upset. Oh, I could change my words. Well, yes, of course, right? That's what editors are for, to see things you don't see, right, by being removed from it and to improve your poetry as a result. And often, not always, but often, their advice is good advice, and it should be listened to or at least considered. So I think that it's useful to get that sort of feedback during the writing and editing process. And if you publish a bunch of short verse and only publish long verse in your own collection, you're not going to get the same level of feedback. I mean, you'll get it from the editor, but only once, right?
Unless you build up a circle of good poet friends who will give you feedback.
Circulate it, exactly. But then you got to have friends who are amenable to the type of poetry you write as well.
So, right, yes.
You know, not many of my friends are amenable to the type of poetry I write. They like something a good deal more modern and a good deal more, I don't know, confessional isn't the right word, but like talking about the self, and I'm just
more totally, personal. Yes.
Yeah. I'm totally uninterested in personal poetry. It doesn't interest me as a reader or an author. So I got to dig up Coleridge, Wordsworth, and Tennyson, get them to help me. Okay. I'm sure that if Harold Bloom heard me say that, after having written The Anxiety of Influence, he would tear his hair out. That's okay. I'm not anxious about my influences. I'm happy. Okay. Now let's take a look at some of Edna St. Vincent Millay, who really does buck the trend of The Anxiety of Influence. She's not terribly interested in recreating the wheel or coming up with new forms. She's just interested in perfecting forms, and her sonnets are exceptional. So we're going to begin with, so we've got several sonnets for you then. Two or three at least. Here's one. This is sonnet number 61 from The Harp Weaver and Other Poems. I, being born a woman and distressed by all the needs and notions of my kind, am urged by your prop iniquity to find your person fair, and feel a certain zest to bear your body's weight upon my breast. So subtly is the fume of life designed to clarify the pulse and cloud the mind, and leave me once again undone, possessed. Think not for this, however, the poor treason of my stout blood against my staggering brain. I shall remember you with love, or season my scorn with pity. Let me make it plain. I find this frenzy insufficient reason for conversation when we meet again. So whenever I give this to my students and I say, I feel this is a very obvious question, what is this poem about? They get stuck. And they can't answer, and they just sit there, and there's silence in the room. And I'm like, well, what is it about? And I'm not sure if it's embarrassment or, you know, difficult verbiage, prop iniquity, right? Or just an inability to tease out the real from the abstract. I mean, it is sort of abstracted, but it seems to me extraordinarily plain.
Oh, no, it's very, very straightforward. Yeah, I mean,
this is about it's a one-night stand, right? So,
right.
You know, the giveaway here, you would think, would be this, the final two lines, right? I find this frenzy insufficient reason for conversation when we meet again. You would think that this would resonate with students who have been brought up on Tinder culture, right? Hookup culture.
Yes,
right?
this is the situation where you've hooked up with someone and then you bump into them in a coffee shop and
exactly.
You don't say anything to each other.
This frenzy, right? This sexual release, indulging in lust and the passion, is not intellectual, which is what conversation is. So Millay sort of compartmentalizes them, separates them from one the other. And I think that that is a That is not a true worldview, right? It's just it is a worldview.
Well, and this poem is remarkable, I think, in a number of ways. Aside from being formally quite sophisticated and very musical, despite its there's nothing entirely musical about the ideas that it's presenting, but it comes across as quite a beautiful poem. There's this boldness about her sexual desires.
Yeah, female sexual
desire. That's really unparalleled in female poetry up until this point.
Mm-hmm.
So this she's assuming a very sort of traditionally masculine way of talking about sexual desire, frankly. I mean, we see this kind of thing from Renaissance male poets all the time.
Indeed.
But here it is
coming
from
Marvell's To His Coy Mistress, right? I mean, it's
exactly.
Blatant.
And the other is simply the open acknowledgement of sexual desire, purely physical sexual desire from a woman. When, you know, before this, there's so much literature about women, much of it written by men, which pretends as if women don't actually have purely physical sexual desires. They only really have emotional desires. But here she's just being very open about having physical sexual desires as a woman and being as frank about it as a man would be.
And totally divorced from the emotional or the intellectual, right? It's
right. And not even putting up a pretense of wanting to, you know, be polite to you afterwards. There's no reason we need to talk now.
Exactly. And I would like to say that it's situated biologically, right? Which makes it, I think, even more potent in some ways. It's not just that this is how the speaker is. It's how all women are. I, being born a woman and distressed by all the needs and notions of my kind. All women. This is the nature of being a woman, right? And I think that's quite interesting. It's not, in a sense, it's not at all personal. I mean, there's the sense in which it's not personal, like she doesn't like him, but it's not at all located in the self. It's a generalized statement where the speaker is saying, you know, this is actually, you know, this is what it is to be a woman. This is the nature of womanhood. And you should be aware of it.
She's not presenting this as a unique experience.
Exactly.
This is something that all women would be able to recognize.
It's a nice way of explaining away any culpability too, right? It's just biology, right?
Which is also very much like the kind of, you know, Renaissance male love poetry, which is, you know, trying to shift the blame onto other things or trying to, you know, overcome objections by giving these very straightforward, logical, biological answers. You know, this is just the birds and the bees. This is just, you know, life is short. And, well, you know, if this mosquito can suck your blood, then why can't we exchange fluids?
Indeed. You know, as another group of poets wrote not too long ago, we ain't nothing but mammals. So let's do it like they do it on the Discovery Channel. Right?
Yes, exactly.
It's a slightly more modern take on the idea, but yes, right? Whether you're Edna St. Vincent Millay or the Bloodhound Gang, nevertheless, you will find here a description of biological determinism over our emotions. In fact, it subordinates the self totally, right? Because the self is expressed emotionally, in a sense, right? There's some sort of intellectual process taking place even at the emotional level. But here, even that is pushed out. We just have the pure biology.
But we also have some language that makes me think of this in very classical terms, especially in the kind of bacchanalian, pan kind of sense. She talks about possessed and she talks about frenzy. And both of these show up in classical sexual poetry all the time. There's this quality of feeling like you're possessed, of being put into a frenzy, and there's no way to stop what happens next.
No, that's right, right? And I think the inability to stop it is what's key for me. It's in some ways it inverts the expectation of female love poetry. Think about Elizabeth Barrett Browning writing poetry about Robert, right? It wouldn't look like this. This is inconceivable. This could never have come from the pen of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. It's impossible. Think about her most famous sonnet, you know, where she writes about her love for her husband, right? How do I love thee? Let me count the ways, right? Where do we get from that, right? Well, we get union with Christ. That's where that poetry leads, right? It's elevating. Love becomes the elevating thing. It takes us out of the biological, the purely mortal, terminal, you know, quotidian realities of life, and it fixes us to the eternal, the unchanging.
But you know where you get a discourse similar to this from women writers and even women poets before, it's even in the Middle Ages. It's in mystical writings where the experience of the divine is described in terms of ecstasy, described in terms of possession, described in terms of ravishing. And so I think we can find the parallel to this kind of thing in a lot of medieval mystical works by women and men. But in terms of just being explicitly and frankly about male-female relations, you get very little of this by women in between the classical period.
is there stuff in the classical period that's as frank from the female perspective?
Yeah, there is in Sappho.
Oh yeah, okay, but, good. That's fair. Fair point.
But not really much in between Sappho and this. There's very little like that, except for mystical stuff.
Yeah. So this is we can see this as an effort to reclaim, right? To reclaim the Sapphic tradition.
Yes. Well, and that's what Camille Paglia says about Edna St. Vincent Millay, is that she's sort of doing something that was lost in the classical period and reviving it. I also think of this in terms of, you know, the progression of the way women appear in pop culture throughout the 20th century. I mean, this is roughly equivalent. This is roughly at the same time, simultaneous is the word I meant. Roughly simultaneous with the career of someone like Katharine Hepburn, who's the first woman in public to be wearing pants and to, you know, say she wants to behave like a man. She wants to be treated as frankly as a man and to be as frank about her sexuality as men are. So, I mean, I can see in Edna St. Vincent Millay a kind of trailblazer for Katharine Hepburn, who's just a little bit younger.
Yes. I mean, what was it Katharine Hepburn said in that famous interview with Barbara Walters, right? I put on pants 50 years ago, something like that.
Right, yeah.
Right, because they used to mock her in the mid-20th century for wearing pants, trousers. Right? Women didn't wear trousers. Katharine Hepburn wore trousers. That was a thing, right? Mm-hmm. But she never gave up her womanhood. I think that was the point of the quote, right? I put on pants, but right. I found some sort of central ground or middle way or something. And
yeah,
and I think we kind of see something like that here, right? This isn't something totally new, as you point out, right? It's in the Sapphic tradition. It's a reclaiming or a regrounding where women have been pushed so far in one direction. The effort is to push back and kind of, you know, develop some sort of equanimity. Mm-hmm. There's so much to say about this poem, and it's really interesting. But I think that for me, it's this first seven lines, which are the first sentence. There's two sentences in the poem. First seven lines are a sentence, and the last five lines are a sentence. And the first seven lines are about a rationale or an excuse, right? Here's why this happened. Because of biology. So there's actually, it's an excusing away of any intellectual or emotional culpability, right? It's not that I found you attractive. It's not that I was emotionally needy, right? Both of those things would suggest a vulnerability on the part of the speaker. No, it's biology, right? The needs and notions of my kind, right, urged me to find you fair, urged me to feel a certain zest, to feel you on top of me.
And it's right. Not really even about you.
Yeah,
there's something that drives me to find what your mating signals.
Exactly.
Something receptive.
Exactly. Right. It's about my biology. So subtly is the fume of life designed to clarify the pulse and cloud
line.
The mind. Right. And leave me once again undone, possessed. And that's it. That last line, that last word in that long seven-line sentence, leave me once again undone, possessed, is, I think, the only time in the poem that the agency of the speaker is ever called into question. The idea of possession, right? Mm-hmm. In this moment, this one word in the poem, right? In this instant of life, she was possessed. But that's it. And then, once again, we pull back. The suddenness of it too, right? As we descend into the fume of life and into the red haze and into the lustful conduct, and then immediately think not, right?
Yes, well, that's the volta in exactly. the sonnet. That's where the octet ends and the sextet begins.
Exactly.
It's perfectly timed.
And it's beautifully done, right? It's just because you descend into it, and as you're reading the poem, you realize what the poem is discussing, and you realize it's discussing a sexual, you know, conquest by the woman, right? And then suddenly we're out of it. Think not, you know, correction. If you were starting to think, if you were the listener, the man, right? If you were starting to think that maybe, you know, there would be another contretemps right down the road, or something more might develop. No, check yourself. Think not for this. The poor treason of my stout blood against my staggering brain. The brain rejects you, right? The brain wants nothing to do with you. It was treason by my biology. I shall remember you with love or season my scorn with pity, right? I'm not even going to think of you. I won't remember you. Don't even think that I'll remember you. Don't even think that there will be any pity amidst my scorn for you. Wow. It's not just, it's not even just like we don't need to speak when we see each other. It's harsh, right?
Sleeping so it was
with
very
you
frank.
Is treason. My biology committed treason against my brain. Like, I know better than to sleep with you.
There's another sonnet that I didn't pick out, but almost did amongst the many that I read before this recording, in which she describes sitting and thinking about the unnumbered bodies that she had been entwined with. There were so many she couldn't keep count, and she'd forgotten many of them. So she's very frank about this throughout her poetic career. I love this phrase, fume of life.
Yeah.
Because fume has so many connotations, and all of them seem appropriate in some way to this. And I wouldn't want to pin it down to any one of them. I mean, fumes are, you know, the kind of poisonous odors that one doesn't want to breathe because they will kill you. And I think that's certainly part of what she's describing here. But then fumes are also suggestive of, you know, the vaporous quality of life. You know, man's life's a vapor, ephemeral, just a smoke. And then, of course, the fume can also be related to the smoke caused by a fire. And of course, if you think about this sexual passion as a kind of fire, then there's this fume of life that it generates, fume of life, because the sexual passion is the source of generativity for the species. So, I mean, there's so many ways in which this fume of life could be interpreted, and I think she means all of them at once.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, right? The multivariant nature of how fume can operate is the point, which is wonderful because, of course, what it's supposed to do in the next line is to clarify.
Right, exactly.
The fume of life designed to clarify the pulse and cloud the mind. See, that's what it does. It clouds our mind, but it clarifies only the pulse. The fume of life has a biological function. And that makes sense, right? It's the fume of life. Mm-hmm. This idea in this poem is that, let me back up and I'll say one of the things about this poem, as I mentioned earlier, is it expresses a worldview, and it's a purely materialistic one, right? It's a worldview where the emotions are ruled by biology, and even the intellect is ruled by biology. There's a certain sense in which they're almost unreal. They are subservient at best. And so when we talk about the fume of life, we're talking about something extraordinarily potent in the world of the poem. This is the ultimate power. The biological power is being expressed here. So it really does exert. I mean, if there's a God in this poem, that's where it is. It's life, biology. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We can think of the fume of life almost like the Holy Spirit, right? It kind of stands in for it. There it is, right? This cloud.
Well, and this also, I think, is a very sort of classical picture of the gods, so to speak. I mean, the forces that the gods represent are very often the forces of nature that are so overwhelming that they have an agency of their own and drive human agents along in ways that we can't always explain. So I think there's something very classical about that thought, too.
So once we explain this to the students, we walk through it and slowly tease it apart. They love it. Students love this poem. And I think one of the reasons for it is that it does really, in some ways, represent a certain zeitgeist that operates today, right? As I said, it is a sort of hookup culture idea, but also the idea of women as sexually powerful, expressive forces. I'm sure Camille Pelley would have loved this. That was kind of her axe to grind in the 90s, right? That women should kind of seize the sapphic power and wield it.
Right.
and not cede that field to men. And I think this poem shows someone doing that. And this is, of course, written in the mid-20th century. And yet it's just as potent, perhaps even more timely now than when it was written.
Do we know, is this from the 20s or the 30s? I can't remember when in her career this is.
When did The Harp Weaver? I think this came out relatively early in her career, 1920s or 30s. But let's see. It was published in 1920s? No, that's not right. Okay, let's see. 1924.
Okay.
The Harp Weaver and Other Poems, April, by Edmund Vincent Millay. Here's The Atlantic writing their review of it. It's one of the wonderful things about the internet. You get all these things, right? Florence Converse writing in The Atlantic, reviewing this. Never did ashes in the mouth sing a sweeter song. Never did the poetry of disillusion pipe a tenderer note than in this small, distinguished volume of lyrics. In most of the poetry books of our 20th century versifiers, we expect to turn over empty page on page for the sake of the gleanings, the real poem here and there, half a dozen in 100 pages. So and so at his best, we say. But open this little book where you will, and the perfect lyric flashes from the page. And the review goes on in that vein.
Yeah. Well, this is Millay at the height of her powers and popularity. And I think that collection is one of the ones for which she won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yes. Yeah. This is 1923, published by Harper Brothers in New York, and X plus 93 pages. It was $2 back then. I mean, she's compared to Shakespeare. She won the Pulitzer in 1922, it looks like. She had just won the Pulitzer.
I have a hard time imagining formal poetry getting such high praise in Atlantic nowadays.
No 15th century ballad ever moved to a rhythm more inevitable and more naive, nor told its tale with more elusive magic. None of the old simplicities are lost. Modern woof on ancient warp, the harp weaver weaves her song. They sing more than most, these sonnets, and again they stand the Shakespearean test of passion saturated with imagination. Mm. I can't imagine higher praise. At all.
No, it's making the critics wax poetic, isn't it?
Yeah. And look at the quality of the criticism, the excellence of the prose. That's really wonderful.
Yes.
Thank you, Florence Converse, about whom I know nothing, to be quite honest. But she was evidently the poetry critic on The Atlantic back in 1924 when she reviewed this 1923 publication. And I think if we just look at this one poem, in which we've spent the better part of 20 minutes now, you'll see. And there's so much more we could say. It's astonishing. What a great sonnet. All right. As I said, that's probably her most famous short poem. Let's look at some others. We have something. I think we'll also do this since we're talking about love. Why not talk about beauty as well? We'll move on to another sonnet. And this one, both Drew and I picked out. And I'll let Drew read it. It's on geometry, of all things, in a way.
This is the sixth sonnet in a short collection called Eight Sonnets, which was published in American Poetry 1922. Euclid alone has looked on beauty bare. Let all who prate of beauty hold their peace, and lay them prone upon the earth, and cease to ponder on themselves, the while they stare at nothing, intricately drawn nowhere in shapes of shifting lineage. Let geese gabble and hiss, but heroes seek release from dusty bondage into luminous air. O blinding hour, O holy, terrible day, when first the shaft into his vision shone of light anatomized. Euclid alone has looked on beauty bare. Fortunate they who, though once only and then but far away, have heard her massive sandal set on stone.
Fantastic.
I just love this poem.
Absolutely fantastic. Euclid alone has looked on beauty bare. That should be in everyone's stock of quotes.
Yes.
Incredible. What a line. But the music of it, gabble and hiss. Let geese gabble and hiss. But heroes seek release from dusty bondage into luminous air. It's incredible.
It really is.
Wonderful line. Wonderful. Absolute complete mastery of meter. Fantastic.
And it also, I mean, it shows how sophisticated her concept of beauty and love were. You know, you might come to the false conclusion from the previous poem that she had a purely physical, materialistic, biological sense of
exactly
of love and beauty. But here she's showing you she gets it in its sort of Platonic ideal. Mm-hmm. There's this beauty that
Euclidean
is so
ideal.
Right, exactly. There's a beauty that is
sacred
so
geometry.
Above all physical expressions of beauty that the closest we can get to it is geometry.
Yeah. Of course, this is what Pythagoras and Euclid were on about, right?
Right, exactly. These were religious mystics. They were not just mathematicians. They were religious mystics.
I know. We how often, you know, how much more interesting would algebra have been if the teachers focused just a little bit, right? You learn Pythagorean theorem, right?
Yes.
But for Pythagoras, it wasn't just a convenient way to find out the hypotenuse of a triangle, right? I mean, it was...
No, it was a path to God, really.
Exactly. It's an expression of the perfectness of the universe. That this always works, right? This is a proof. That's what a proof is. It's a,
yes.
We think of a proof as being, to prove a rule. And it is that. I mean, that's what a proof is. But a proof is also a proof of the order of the universe, that it was created in an ordered way by a creator, right? I mean, it's a proof of God that, you know, there are laws, physical laws and mathematical laws that don't need to exist. There's no reason why numbers have to work the way they do, but that they express a perfectness.
The music of the spheres.
Exactly. So this is, I think, a really useful corollary to the poem we just read, which is so biologically determinist, so materialist, right, that people affect almost have no will of their own, seems to be the argument of the previous poem. And here, beauty is only, in its real sense, it's a purely intellectually achievable thing.
Yes.
Right? That's why it's Euclid alone who can conceive of beauty, right? He can intellectualize it and understand it in the abstract and the numerical sense, right? In terms of its sacred geometry. It's not simply about going and looking at the Mona Lisa and saying, that's pretty. That's not real beauty. Real beauty is understanding the mathematical and geometrical reasons why it is pretty.
Right. It's the kind of thing that when somebody is looking at a piece of exquisite art, the thing that they for a moment catch glimpse of, that they can't put their finger on, that is beyond whatever that object of their gaze happens to be. And that's what she describes here at the end. Fortunate they who, though once only and then but far away, have heard her massive sandals set on stone. All the most perceptive people can ever really catch of real beauty, of its Platonic ideal, is just the stamp of her foot. Her massive foot, like a titanic being stepping on the stone. It reminds me of the vision of God that Moses has. Moses said to God, I want to see you face to face. And God said, well, you can't because you'll die. But what I'll do is I'll put you in the cleft of this rock and I'll walk by. And then you can see my backside as I walk by. That's the sort of thing that's happening here. There's something so overwhelming that the human eye can't behold it, except a little glimpse one time of some piece of it.
It really is like the Platonic ideal, right? That when you look at a horse, its horseness is expressed in the ways in which it conforms to the ideal, which doesn't exist in the world, but is beyond it. Or right. The Kantian sublime, if you prefer, right? So it's a highly abstract and intellectual notion that's only expressed kind of in a rudimentary way through the accidental affects of art and things that we see on Earth. And I think what this does is it forces us, when you read this poem, to kind of reevaluate the poem we just read, which is you know, what good poetry by a poet does. You know, they all work together as part of the IRV to make you think about how the poems function together. And then you suddenly begin to see that that the biological argument being made in I Being Born a Woman and Distressed is not a reflection of the poet's worldview. It's a way of attacking the subject of the poem, right? Or a way of distancing. And it suggests a vulnerability, in fact, which is otherwise invisible in that poem. There doesn't seem to be anything vulnerable about the speaker. But once you realize that actually the language of the speaker is something of a defense mechanism, right? A way of creating distance.
It suggests to me something more about that fume of life.
Indeed.
I mean, you could interpret it in a purely biological sense. This is the drive to mate. But then there's also this drive to seek the beautiful that is part of the fume of life as well. And here she seems to suggest that this drive to seek the beautiful, you know, it will afford us glimpses of what beauty really is. But Euclid alone has seen beauty bare. You know, it's really beyond what we can grasp, even though we're driven to seek it. And this juxtaposition of these two poems, which might at first glance suggest two conflicting world pictures, I think we see this all the time in Renaissance poets. Somebody like John Donne, for instance, who's writing, you know, quite explicit poetry about love and sex, and then some of the most exquisite devotional poetry that's ever been written. And you see the same juxtaposition in Robin Herrick as well, who in the same collection will have, you know, somewhat ribald love poetry and then works of devotion.
I think the two have to work together, right? Like to really have a mastery of the one, you need the other.
Oh, well, that's sort of Dante's point, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's his rather basic physical love for Beatrice that transforms, it blossoms into something that helps him to ascend up to love of God.
Let's look at just a line of this before we move on, if we might. Oh, blinding hour! Oh, holy, terrible day! When first the shaft into his vision shone of light anatomized. Light anatomized.
Mm.
That's what a fantastical of light anatomized, the anatomy of light. And the question, of course, is not whether we're supposed to understand this in the literal sense of what is the anatomy of, like through a prism, right? Light anatomized.
Yeah, the idea it's refracted.
Yes.
And that's, of course, we can only see light in its refractions because light, pure light is too overwhelming.
Indeed.
For us to
blinding
to see.
Hour.
Yes, exactly. What is that immortal, invisible, God only wise? There's that wonderful line, is only the brilliance of light hideth thee, or something like that.
Yeah,
I've got it wrong,
like that,
but that's the idea.
It's the opposite of, is it Auden? When such clouds of vapor did arise that only the God's eyes did not close, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's Auden. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's Yeats. No, it might be Yeats. Sounds like Yeats. That's not Auden. So there's this sense, right, of the seeing divine is connected to light and to fume, and that binds these two sonnets together, right? The sight of the divine, the essential life, beauty, and love are connected to sort of biological experiences, to seeing, to smelling, to feeling, but they betray their divine origins ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And in this poem, we take that apart and we look at it. We say, "Well, wait, where is beauty? Is beauty just in the biological? Is beauty just fume of life making me desire someone because they have certain attributes, and so I want them to have sex with me? Is that all beauty is? No. Beauty is actually mathematical. It is purely intellectual, not biological at all."
And it's also interesting, this line, from dusty bondage into luminous air. Heroes seek release from dusty bondage into luminous air. And so this suggests that what drives us to heroic action is this seeking of something we can't put our finger on, this seeking of ultimately beauty or goodness or truth, all of these things combined. And this drives us beyond our dusty state, you know, the dust thou art and unto dust shalt thou return. The dusty bondage is the physicality of man, into luminous air. So this is you know, the apotheosis, apotheosis of the hero at the end of a myth.
Right, the dusty bondage is the creation, right? From dust you were made.
Right.
But we don't want to return to dust. We want to be turned into luminous air, to transcend,
to ascend
the nature
with
of our existence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let's look at our next poem, which is not a sonnet this time, because I think it isn't. I got to pull it up. This is a dirge without music, and it is not a sonnet. In fact, it's got very long lines, and it's in four stanzas of four lines each, but the lines are of varying lengths. In the first and third stanzas, the lines are longer, and in the second and fourth stanzas, they're shorter, and there is a rhyme scheme, and the rhyme scheme is A-B, and I'll read it. And I want to apologize also before I do, if you're hearing me coughing. I'm still very ill, and I am getting it seen to, but in the meantime, I have to be off of medication for the tests, so I will be coughing occasionally. I'm trying to muffle it. I don't have a cough button on my microphone, so I have to like turn my head and bury my face in my shoulder. So I apologize. Hopefully soon, we'll get it sorted. This is Dirge Without Music. I am not resigned to the shutting away of loving hearts in the hard ground. So it is, and so it will be, for so it has been time out of mind. Into the darkness they go, the wise and the lovely. Crowned with lilies and with laurel they go, but I am not resigned. Lovers and thinkers, into the earth with you. Be one with the dull, the indiscriminate dust. A fragment of what you felt, of what you knew, a formula, a phrase remains, but the best is lost. The answers quick and keen, the honest look, the laughter, the love, they are gone. They are gone to feed the roses. Elegant and curled is the blossom, fragrant is the blossom. I know, but I do not approve. More precious was the light in your eyes than all the roses in the world. Down, down, down into the darkness of the grave, gently they go, the beautiful, the tender, the kind. Quietly they go, the intelligent, the witty, the brave. I know, but I do not approve, and I am not resigned. We've been very fortuitous in our selection of poetry today, and that one poem seems inexorably to connect to the previous poem. And here, too, right, we have the reminder, be one with the dull, the indiscriminate dust, the connection to what heroes desire to aspire beyond, right? To be more than the dull, indiscriminate dust. And here the speaker seems to accept the reality of death, right? You can't simply be transformed into luminous air.
But it's also not resigned.
Yeah, you know, but yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, it accepts the reality of it, but is not resigned to it. And I wonder, what is, when the poet here says, I am not resigned, at the end of the first and the fourth stanza, what does it mean to not be resigned?
Well, for one thing, it might be a refusal to accept some kind of bright explanation of how, you know, this is the circle of life, and this is just how things are, and you've just got to quickly come to terms with it. She doesn't want to quickly come to terms with the death of these people. But then I think there's a larger point here about death itself being something to be defied, that there's something, you know, she does point to and then reject a sort of naturalistic explanation. You know, they go into the earth and they provide fertilization for the flowers, and the flowers are beautiful, and then you'll remember them and think, oh, well, this is the circle of life. But she says, no, the light in your eyes is more to me than any of these roses, and there's something wrong about death. It's not just the way things are.
So I think part of this is it equivocates on what we would say the word, you know, like acceptance of death, right? Equivocates on the word acceptance, right? Here, the word that is used is I know. Right. So we might say that the poet accepts death in the intellectual sense. She says, I know, right? I know that, you know, the bodies go into the earth, they nourish the flowers. I know that, you know, people have to die. I know. And then she says, but I do not approve, right? I do not approve of this, that this order of things is not satisfactory to her. So she has a, if we accept that there's a creator of the universe, then the speaker has a beef with him. It's not acceptable. I do not approve. So there's an intellectual assent, like an awareness of what is transpiring, and that is different than resignation.
Right.
Which I guess the difference would be that one is resigned to it if one says, well, this is how it has to be. And she, not approving, is therefore not resigned. Atheistical argument without being atheist, right? Like, well, actually, it doesn't have to be this way. And that doesn't mean that there isn't a God. It just means that God is wrong, right?
Well, I mean, part of the point of the Christian message about death is that it is wrong.
Indeed.
And you're not supposed to ever just come to terms with it. It's the thing that is to be overcome. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
It's some kind of curse that we're trying to get away from.
So would you say this poem is consistent with a Christian ethos? My sense is that she's upset with a God that permits it, right? That this, the I do not approve.
Well, I would say that it's impossible to tell on this, the basis of this poem alone, whether or not she's, what's the larger world picture that goes behind this? You've got to read that into it. You could read this in a kind of atheistic, mad at God kind of way, which isn't really atheism. It's resentment.
You can't be mad at God and be an atheist.
Right. Exactly. But you can also read this, I think, in a way that's quite consistent with a fairly typical Christian idea of, you know, when Jesus encountered the death of his friend, he wept as if death was not something just to resign yourself to, but something to be mourned. And she does resist and reject the kind of funeral oration that you might hear in a purely humanistic context.
Yes.
You go into the ground and you feed the flowers, and this is the cycle of life. And isn't it beautiful? They're not really dead. They've just transmuted into this other form of life. And she says, that's not comforting at all.
I know, she says. Yeah, like, duh. I know, but I do not approve. And I think that's the line that gets me, and it shows up in Sansa 3 and in Sansa 4, but I do not approve. I think if it were just, I am not resigned, I could read this poem in a way that rejects death, but it's the approval. Something about approval is it's different than it's merely not being resigned, right? I am not resigned. I mean, resignation is a passive thing, right? But when you say approval is an active thing, I do not approve, it's somehow different. It suggests
rebellion. What is she not approving of? If she's not approving of death, then God's response to that is, well, neither do I, because I didn't design it to be that way.
I don't think it is death, right? I think it's the order of things is the problem.
Ah, yes, yes. I don't approve of nature.
Yeah, I don't approve of the way that this is set up, that this is how it has to be, right? I think the resignation is about death, right? I am not resigned that's about death, right? I'm not simply resigned to the fact that this is how it is. I reject that. And that would be totally consistent with the Christian ethos. Death is to be rejected. It's to be avoided and so on and so forth. But the I do not approve, that's a different thing. That strikes me as weighing in on the order of things.
But of course, we know the order of things is fundamentally broken.
It is.
And there's a sense in which that's a legitimate thing to say.
The difference is that when I say the order of things here, I mean like the totality of it, that God permits it. God permits death, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where I see her saying, I don't approve. This is too much. God should not permit death. I am not resigned. Well, you know, then you can, that for me, somehow that works within the worldview. Okay, this is unacceptable, but I'm not withholding or weighing in on the totality of it. Something about approval just seems to encompass the whole in a way resignation does not.
She's certainly not doing the kind of, Alexander Pope thing in the Essay on Man, where he talks about things that are tragic and says, you know, that they're tragic within themselves, but within the grand picture, they're all part of a whole, and the entire outcome of all of this is going to be good. And therefore, as he famously says in the last line, whatever is right.
Yes, that's resignation.
The point,
right? Or that's
she's not doing
that's
that.
Approval. Without resignation is what I should say. But here we don't even have the approval, right? Like Pope approves because whatever is right, right? So you have to approve of it. But he's not happy about the tragedy, right? I mean, that's right. So he's not resigned, but he does approve. Here we don't even have the approval. You can imagine Millet reading Pope's Essay on Man and saying, no.
Right, exactly.
No. In this circumstance, this is wrong. It is not right just because it serves God's ends. It's wrong. And so she doesn't approve either. There's a withholding of even of that. And that's what I always, when I read this, I'm like, this is very interesting. Because superficially, when you read this, if you're familiar with Dylan Thomas's very famous poem, Do Not Go Gently Into That Good Night, you get a sort of sense of that here, right? Mm-hmm. But this is a very different poem. Whereas that poem is... speaking to the dying, which is all of us really, to resist death. Millet is after the death, right? It's a funeral oration, as it were. Thinking reflectively about the deaths that have transpired and weighing them in the balance rather than counseling us to try to resist death. It says, you know, death is bad, look back on it and don't accept it either.
I find there's something refreshingly honest about what she says there. I mean, anyone that's ever been to the funeral of someone you're quite close to and felt at a kind of visceral level how unfair that is and how angry it makes you, it somehow seems exactly spot on to say, I just don't approve. I will not be resigned to this. I think there's something very honest about it, whether or not it's making a larger point about the order of things, I don't know. But I wanted to say something also about the title that ties into all of that. The title is Dirge Without Music. which you could take rather literalistically and say, well, it's just words. There's no music to go along with it. But dirge without music also could suggest, if music is thought of as sort of a comforting thing, mm-hmm. a thing that mm-hmm. allows us to come to terms with what we can't put into words, then the lack of music here is the lack of comfort in this, the lack of anything soothing. This is just the death, bald-faced and ugly.
No,
it's also ironic
right.
to say it's without music because it is very musical.
But it's not light, which I think is important.
No, not light.
Right? It's the music of... Oh, you know, the funeral dirge, Chopin's Piano Concerto number 2, right? That we all, don, 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 that sort of thing, right? It's the
Well, it makes
heavy...
me think of the dies irae, dies illa.
Yes.
Which shows up all the time in music about death.
Exactly, right? It doesn't lift you up or make you feel better. mm-hmm. Although it is a kind of music, right? It's a dirge.
Yeah.
But in this case, you know, it's a dirge that doesn't lift the way that music does. It's a dirge without music. Just the poem itself is like that in some ways. Many of its rhymes are sight rhymes, which I think is really, really clever mm-hmm. for what it is, right? Because it is the formal component, but it has none of the musicality.
Right. It's right? without the comfort that a real rhyme can provide.
Exactly.
The one a rhyme in the ear rather than just on the page.
Right. You look at dust and lost. You look at love and approve. Right. And you think to yourself, this is interesting because these are rhymes without music.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's the fact of the thing. It's the dirge, but without the lightness, the music that lifts it up. So it is really, really astonishing as a piece of poetic craft. Formally, I mean, it's incredible.
Yes.
And it also, the lines are so long that some of them contain multiple sentences. I mean, the third line of the third stanza is four sentences,
yes.
right? One is in jammed from the previous line, is the blossom, full stop. Fragrant is the blossom, full stop. I know, full stop, but I do not approve, full stop. All in one line. And the previous line is similar. It's got three sentences in it, one which is in jammed to the next line. They are gone. Full stop. They are gone to feed the roses. Full stop. Elegant and curled. This sharp delineation between very basic, simple sentences inside of a line is like a heavy tread, like the heavy tread of Dickinson's Funeral, right? I felt a funeral in my brain, the heavy tread,
mm-hmm.
right? They are gone. They are gone to feed the roses. Elegant and curled is the blossom. Fragrant is the blossom. I know, but I do not approve. Punch, 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 punch. Each one, right?
Yes.
These are the sort of pablum that you're told. They're gone. They're gone to feed the roses, pretty roses. Yes, I know, but I don't approve.
Yes. There's also some really lovely alliteration in this. A fragment of what you felt, of
yes.
what you knew, a formula, a phrase remains. Mm-hmm. And then in the next line, the quick and the keen. The honest look, the laughter, the love.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice alliteration throughout this.
Fantastic poem. Even if I'm ambivalent about its theological implications.
Although I don't think that it has to be read as trying to make a larger theological statement. I think you can read it as the visceral response that a person has to death.
Yes, I suppose. but it exposes, like, it subtly exposes the speaker's theological concepts for me.
I think you just want it to be something else.
Possibly. Right?
It's like, I hear what you're saying, but you could have said this.
Yes. No, that you're quite right. I mean, that's it exactly. Right.
Yes.
But as a piece of poetic craft, I think it's fantastic. I would like it to be different than it is in the end.
I did have, you were speaking earlier about responses that you get from editors when you submit a poem and how often they're very, very, very helpful. And that's been my experience as well. But there was one time I got a response from an editor that made me want to throw my laptop across the room. He basically said, this is a fine idea, but I wish you would have written a different poem. And this is the poem I want you to write instead. I thought, well, that's fine, but you're rejecting the poem that I sent you. And I have no intention of writing the one you just described. If you want to have that poem, go write it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. lovely, lovely history of England you've written, but I'd much prefer history of Italy. Could you write that?
Exactly.
Oh, dear. Well, we have time for one more, I think, although we'll have to give a somewhat brief treatment. And Drew has asked that we read the second sonnet from 8 sonnets published in American Poetry in 1922, and so I'll let him do that. I think it connects nicely with what we've just read. One more sonnet.
What's this of death from you who never will die? Thank you, the wrist that fashioned you in clay, the thumb that set the hollow just that way in your full throat, and lidded the long eye so roundly from the forehead, will let lie broken, forgotten, underfoot someday your unimpeachable body, and so slay the work he most had been remembered by. I tell you this, whatever of dust to dust goes down, whatever of ashes may return to its essential self in its own season, loveliness such as yours will not be lost, but cast in bronze upon its very urn, make known him master, and for what good reason?
I'm really glad you picked this. It does two things. First, it connects again to the poem we've just read. Here we are again with the idea of death. What's this of death from you who will never die, who never will die? But then it does do something, I think, uplifting. So we don't have to end the podcast on such a dirge-like note. Mm. It does seem to suggest a sort of immortality, doesn't it?
Oh, I think quite explicitly.
Yeah.
Of two kinds. It suggests the possibility of something returning to its essential self, whatever of ashes may return to its essential self in its own season. So that is admitting the possibility of some kind of afterlife, but then also the immortality in the purely earthly sense of something beautiful that remains on record, as it were,
yeah.
And has that kind of immortality. And it does what we have seen so often in poetry from the classical period all the way through, of suggesting that the poem itself is providing immortality to
exactly.
a beautiful thing.
It's very Keatsian, right?
Yes, yes.
You think of Ode on Aggression Earned, a very similar thing here without the depiction, right? But the idea is, once again, there's going to be a bronze urn, immortality, right? Time will be frozen for you. And then the poem does a similar job, much as Keats' right. ode immortalizes the urn and what's on it, just as the urn does. This poem immortalizes the bronze, just as the bronze urn itself does. That goes, we see that in Shakespeare, though, don't we? Shakespeare in his sonnets
yes.
does exactly
mm-hmm.
the same thing.
Yeah, the poet is able to grant immortality to whatever it praises. And there's also this wonderful description of the creation of that singular human being. It reminded me a bit of the Johnson poem, The Creation, that we read a couple of months ago. But in this case, it's not the creation of humanity as such. It's the creation of a singular human being who is just quite beautiful. And the sort of sculpting that goes into that, the care of an artist to create a beautiful person, I think it's really quite well described. Even the hollow of the neck, I just love that. The thumb that set the hollow just that way.
Just so. And I think here we see something very paternal in the nature of the creator, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the grammar of this first stanza is very complicated. But basically what it boils down to is, do you believe that the hand that made you would let you lie broken underfoot and thereby, you know, allow the ruin of the thing that was meant to memorialize him, right?
And so yes, there's imagine, that death-defying.
Yeah, exactly.
Thing
right.
That,
this is an act.
You weren't made to die. You were made to be
exactly.
something that honors this creator.
And that transcends purely like the creator of an urn. I mean, that
right.
is just as much a thing that can be said to people about God.
Right.
Do you believe that God, who made you and set you above all the other animals and gave you all of creation, would allow you to perish utterly? You, the thing that was made to praise God, right? To be in union with him. Do you believe he would let you lie in the dust? There's something very Christian about this kind of conception of creation and the relationship between the creator and the created.
Yes, no, there is. And there's even a very explicit Christian reference here, dust to dust, mm-hmm. which is a phrase that Thomas Cranmer put into the prayer book's burial service, probably one of the most familiar phrases that the prayer book has.
Indeed. Well, thank you for bringing this final poem to our attention. I think it's a wonderful way to end a little trip through the collected works of Edna St. Vincent de Millay.
Remember that this poem that we just read is number 2 in the same collection that the Euclid poem is number 6. So if you read this whole collection of 8, I think you get a really marvelous picture, not only of love physically, but also of love transcendent.
Absolutely. I think, you know, in retrospect, you're probably right. None of these poems can give you a totality of the worldview of the author. You really do need to kind of read them together. I think mm-hmm. they illuminate each other. And I think that also shows that there's not the New Critics didn't get everything right all the time in every place. They would love us to read the poems in isolation in the totality of each individual poem and not accept or bring in anything from the outside if we could avoid it. And I tend to be very on board with the New Critics, and I tend to adopt that approach generally. But there are times, right? Rules exist to be bent now and again. There are times when bringing in other stuff from the author, bringing in biological details, is illuminating. And
biographical details, too.
Indeed, absolutely.
But you said the biological details, which I think was a slip.
Oh, yeah, it was a slip, but it's true.
It works quite well.
It happens to be correct, right, in this case. Fortuitous slip. Well,
no,
thank you
very much.
I think
that the new critics are like doing criticism with one hand tied behind your back. You can do it, but there's a whole other hand there to use.
I know, but I think it's a good. I think if you're going to do a serious reading of the poem, they give us a good ground, right? That's where you start. Start inside.
Yes,
the poem.
Yes. Start with close reading. That's exactly. That's their great contribution to the history of literature.
Now, in explanation thereof, I'll say that I was trained by people who were expert close readers. So that's what it was. All I did as an undergraduate was close reading after close mm-hmm. reading after close reading. So even though they weren't necessarily new critics themselves, they're new historicists and things of that sort. They believe that you started with close reading.
Yeah.
And then maybe you brought in other stuff if you needed to. And so that's the kind of approach you get from me on the podcast here. All right. Well, thank you very much, Drew. Excuse me for coming along with us and taking us to these wonderful sonnets, just really exquisite. And I think give proof to the assertion that Harold Bloom wasn't always right. You know, she was not a mediocre poet by any stretch of the imagination. Some of these sonnets are simply astonishing. You know, 50, 60 years later, we've had plenty of time for any, novelty to wear off. And yet here they are, as stunning as
they
were.
Richard Wilbur was right. These are some of the most exquisite sonnets we have.
Yeah, and they should be read. Read these. Good stuff. Incidentally, you can get a nice big book of Edna St. Vincent Millay online for very little money these days, as with all poetry. Not a bad idea. Probably not the $2 that it debuted at in 1923, unfortunately, but not much more than that, actually, which tells you something about how little our society values these wonderful works of art and culture. All right. Well, next week we will be back, and I'm not sure what we'll be looking at, although I have an idea, but I don't want to give it away just yet. So please do tune in. And if you'd like a hint, you can always follow us on Twitter, where we are Crit Readings. And if you do that, we try to tweet out the occasional picture of what's coming up next week to give you a little teaser. And you can also comment and respond to us there, and we will see your comments and read them on the air. So thank you to all those who respond and let us know that they're enjoying the podcast. Thank you also, of course, to Drew, without whom there wouldn't be a podcast.
It's been a pleasure.
You don't want to have a podcast without Drew. Imagine 60 minutes of me just reciting the international radio alphabet over and over again. Terrible. And that's what it would be. So luckily,
you could have read sonnets the whole time.
I could have, but I wouldn't. Just the radio alphabet. Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta. Over and over again. Thank you also to our listeners. Some of you who contribute help to offset our server costs. Thank you ever so much. If you'd like to join them, you can go to Critical Readings and click Become a Patron. Some of you who spread the word, tell other people about Critical Readings and share our tweets and find ways to slip Critical Readings into conversations about literature and poetry online. I do see that occasionally. It makes me really, really happy. Thank you. And then some of you who do both. And you are going to be kings and queens in Narnia. Thank you all so much. We'll be back next week with more Critical Readings. Until then, from all of us here, Godspeed. You've been listening to Critical Readings. With special thanks to our supporters, Turnus, Alessandro, Elizabeth, Zach, Scott, Jamie, and Lyndon. Copyright Sean Philip Cooper. All rights reserved.